I heard something really interesting the other day. There was some talk somewhere on the web, and I forget where, saying that there was an actress on a TV show who had had so much Botox done to her face that there was a scene where she had to essay surprise. She was supposed to be very startled by something, and they couldn't get anything above her mouth to register surprise because of the Botox. So what they did was they shot her from the back and had her drop a coffee cup so that they could that way convey the fact that the character was surprised. What does this say about the way women are portrayed in the media? What does this say about actresses' vanity? What does it say about the whole way that movies and television are made in the 21st century? It's a weird thing. I'll give you an example of why. Anyone seen Pick Up on South Street, the Sam Fuller movie? I'm going to talk about it in a future podcast. If you haven't seen it, you're missing out. See it, please. See any Samuel Fuller movie you can get. The guy is worth the effort. But what I'm going to say is Thelma Ritter has a terrific death scene in Pick Up on South Street. You'll know which one it is if you've seen the film. And it's pretty damn cool. One of the things that make this work is her face, the character in her face, the fact that she's lived, the fact that she's a woman of a certain age, and the character she's playing is world-weary and tired, and the only thing that the character wants to do is sell enough ties on the street corner to be able to give herself a decent funeral, which shows you the headspace the character's in. And the beauty of the scene is Thelma Ritter's acting and the fact that she has a fantastic character face, terrific actress as well, but she has a fantastic character face which has lines on it. There's so much being missed out by these people who Botox their faces, who try to look like porcelain dolls until death. I think they're losing something there, and also losing a medium of communication between themselves and the audience, and of course between themselves and the people they meet day to day. Character in a face is part of the communication medium, and the fact that Hollywood no longer seems to recognize that is a sad indictment of that particular area of making movies. In other countries, less of a problem. Unfortunately, in Australia, becoming more of a problem. But I really think that it's something that should be reconsidered. The human face, as Martin Scorsese once said in a documentary, is the most interesting thing in the world. Unfortunately, some people are plastering over part of that beauty. My name is Terry Frost, and welcome to Paleo Cinema. Hi, and welcome to Paleo Cinema Podcast number 39, I think, leaving aside the specials. My name is Terry Frost, and this time around I'm looking at John Frankenheimer's Paranoia Trilogy. If you don't know what that is, I'll talk about it in a moment. But first, just to let you know what's going on around here. Summer's coming fast down here in the Southern Hemisphere. The weather's warm. We've had a few thunderstorms, a bit of rain. I've been out on the bike. I've been very, very sedentary during the winter months. But getting back into the exercise again, and I enjoy it too. A few aches and pains, but I found a few new bike paths around the local area, which go down by a nice river. And I am enjoying it. So I've been watching a lot of things, some of which I want to talk about in future podcasts. But I've kind of left the three movies I'm going to talk about today to see only during the last day or so. I've researched them, but I haven't rewatched them until recently. I'm trying to find a different way of approaching the film so I don't get too jaded about them before I talk about them. So anyway, how have you been? Not many emails came through lately, so you guys have been slack. I did have a couple of them, a couple of mentions on Twitter, so I do appreciate that. Keep that up. A few mentions on Facebook. I should also mention that our friend Troy Date has his own website now. He's been a supporter of Paleo Cinema for a while now. If you go to troydate.com, he's got a Halloween special you can download, my music bits and pieces. There are a few links, and he's also starting to talk about movies on that particular blog, so please support him. He supported us, and I'd be more than happy if you did so. We're talking about Paranoia at the moment. John Frankenheimer's Paranoia Trilogy, that's a kind of loosely grouped three films that Frankenheimer made between the years 1962 and 1966. He did make other movies during that time, including The Train with Burt Lancaster, and a movie called All Fall Down with Warren Beatty in it. But the three I'm going to talk about today are The Manchurian Candidate from 1962, starring Frank Sinatra, Lawrence Harvey and Angela Lansbury. The next film I'm going to talk about is 7 Days in May, starring Burt Lancaster, Kirk Douglas and Frederick March. And the last one of all is Seconds, the science fiction horror movie that Frankenheimer did in 1966, starring Rock Hudson. So I'll talk a little bit about Frankenheimer and his career, and then I'll get into the first movie, The Manchurian Candidate. But before I do have to apologize. My throat is a little raspy at the moment. It's not actually sore, but it's kind of a bit hoarse. So if this sounds bad, it may not be the recording. It may just actually be everything between my lips and my lungs. Bear with me. I'll get through it. I'm going to try not to strain the voice too much because it gets worse the more I use it. Nonetheless, we are going to soldier through on this. Play a little bit of a musical sting and then we'll get into the career of John Frankenheimer.
Sensofine, let it always be sensofine. There's no end to our love, our hopes, our dreams, our sighs. No end at all, no sad goodbyes, no fears, no tears. No love that dies, it's sensofine. Let it always be sensofine. Never ending the sunlit days, the moonlit nights, the sea, the sand, the starry heights are yours and mine forever.
That was Connie Francis singing Sensofine. It's an interesting song, that, because the movie it came from is the most unlikely movie to have a love song in it than of any movie that I can think of, apart from maybe, you know, Cannibal Apocalypse or something like that. It came from the original version of The Flight of the Phoenix, and it was played in the background during some of the scenes, and it became a moderate hit for Connie Francis in the early 1960s. But I kind of like it. It also turned up in a totally different context in a movie made around 2000 called Ghost Ship, which was filmed in Australia, but it starred people like Gabriel Byrne. And there's a scene right at the start where a beautiful Italian nightclub singer in a red cocktail dress sings Sensofine, and then something totally unexpected happens. If you get a chance to see Ghost Ship, or even the original Flight of the Phoenix, I suppose, it's worth seeing it just for that version of Sensofine that appears in each one of those films. Anyway, moving along to the career of John Frankenheimer. John Michael Frankenheimer was born on February 19, 1930 and died on July 6, 2002. He was an American filmmaker known for a number of different films. He had a career spanning the 1950s until the 2000s. And he specialised in action films and intelligent thriller kind of movies and all sorts of things. He was born in New York. His parents were fairly wealthy. And he started out doing live television in the 1950s. He worked for CBS and did well over 100 live-to-air dramas at the time. So his apprenticeship as a director was pretty extensive. And he brings some of the tropes from his live television directing years into his movies. There's a lot of things, particularly in The Manchurian Candidate, when there's a lot of depth of focus shots. There's someone in the foreground, someone in the background, and it's framed in the wider cinema format, very similar to the way that live television drama was filmed in the 1950s. There was a continuity there. And, of course, all three of these films that I'm going to mention today, The Manchurian Candidate, 7 Days in May, and Seconds, are in black and white, so they have that continuity with early television. So Frankenheimer did a couple of feature films before this one. He did The Young Stranger, starring James MacArthur, basically a rebellious juvenile delinquent kind of drama. He did The Young Savages and worked with Burt Lancaster on that. That was, again, about juvenile delinquents. Then he did The Birdman of Alcatraz, which with Lancaster again, which was a big hit. And from there, he and his screenwriter, come producer, colleague, George Axelrod, took on board The Manchurian Candidate, which was a very big best-selling novel at the time. It was released in published in 1959. And had been rejected by every movie studio in Hollywood. But Frankenheimer and Axelrod got together. They got Frank Sinatra on board, and that's when the money came flowing in. And they decided that they were going to make this film. Axelrod's script, Frankenheimer has said, is one of the best scripts he has ever read in his life. And of the three films I'm going to mention today, of the films that are in what is known as Frankenheimer's Paranoia Trilogy, this is probably the best. It has one of Frank Sinatra's best acting roles. It has definitely Angela Lansbury's best acting role on film. And it's it was a very timely film for its day. I'll go into a bit of a synopsis of it, play a bit of a sound clip from it, and from there work through why I think it's a film worth your time. I won't go into it too deeply because most of you know it. And if you don't know the film and haven't seen it, or you've seen it ages ago and forgotten it, I don't want to do too many spoilers on it, but basically the central concept of the film is that the son of a prominent right-wing political family has been brainwashed during the Korean War by Russian spies who have taken him to Manchuria, hence the title, and brainwashed him to be an unwitting assassination for an international communist conspiracy. It was released in 1962 at the height of the Cuban Missile Crisis, back when Kennedy was president, and was a big hit. Now, the film subsequently went into a bit of a hiatus for about 20 or 30 years where it wasn't seen at all. The common folk wisdom said that Frank Sinatra buried the film because soon after the film came the assassination of John F. Kennedy, and there were too many parallels between the end of the film and Kennedy's death, that Sinatra, being a family friend, a friend of the Kennedys, wasn't comfortable with it. But that wasn't actually true. There was trouble getting the rights to the film. The studio put it on television briefly several times, but it wasn't until movie buffs got hold of it, when VHS at the time came around, and saw the quality of the film, that it really kind of had a resurgence. It's been released on DVD. It's mentioned by a lot of film critics as a very good example of early 1960s filmmaking, and I can't really argue with that.
Raymond Shaw is the bravest, kindest, warmest, most wonderful human being I've ever known in my life.
I said Raymond Shaw is the kindest, warmest, bravest, most wonderful human being I've ever known in my life. And even now I feel that way, this minute, and yet, somewhere in the back of my mind, something tells me it's not true. It's just not true. It isn't as if Raymond's hard to like. He's impossible to like!
Brainwashing was very much a hot-button topic in the 50s and 60s. During the Korean War, there were, in fact, American soldiers that were brainwashed by the Chinese communists during their conflict when they were captured and were brought up on stage. They were filmed reneging on their vows and saying America was a warmonger and all that sort of thing. And this seemed to have had a profound shock on the American public when they were made aware of it, and, of course, the military as well. If they're own soldiers could be turned against them, where was the future of warfare going to be? So people were very much aware of this and very much concerned about it at the time. We've learned a lot about brainwashing since then. The CIA started a project called MKUltra, where they were looking at using hallucinogenic drugs and other mind control techniques to control people both individually and as a mass. Nothing really came of it until, of course, Fox News came along. But in general, they found out a few things about brainwashing, which aren't really reflected in this film because we hadn't discovered them until after the film happened, that once people leave the stressful environment in which they're brainwashed, they're more likely to revert to their previous behaviours and their previous belief systems and their previous ways of being a person, which is one of the reasons why, in particular, religious cults tend to try to isolate people from their family members. They realise that any kind of indoctrination is reversible. And, of course, you know, isolated communities, you can reinforce that constantly. If somebody has access to a wider world and to wider information and a wider divergence of views, then, of course, they're less likely to retain extreme belief systems imposed upon them by others. Back to the movie, because I've just finished my rant there. This film is a mind-blowing film. One of the things I really like about it is that while the brainwashing is occurring, there's two scenes where the brainwashing occurs, one of which is from the viewpoint of the Frank Sinatra character and the other is from a viewpoint of a black American soldier who was in the platoon captured by the communists and brainwashed. While they're being indoctrinated, they believe that they're sitting in New Jersey watching a symposium about hydrangeas done by middle-aged women. In reality, of course, they're in an amphitheatre full of Chinese communist people who are studying the brainwashing techniques. When the Frank Sinatra character is having a nightmare about the brainwashing, they do a beautiful 360-degree revolve shot. First time around, they see the flower show ladies. Second time around, you see the reality of what's occurring and the big posters of Chairman Mao and Stalin and things like that on the walls, and the participants in the symposium as they actually are. And it was beautifully done. They had to move stage sets and get people to run around while they were filming that scene. They actually had parts of the stage on railroad tracks where they could move it out from behind the camera and replace it with another one, and all the actors climbed back into their positions on there. So it's beautiful in the sense that it increases the surreality of the brainwashing scenes, and also shows how they were perceived by the victims of the brainwashing. And the interesting thing is, when they show the nightmare from the viewpoint of the black soldier, all of the ladies at the flower show are black women. So you've got that beautiful subjectivity to that, which I really liked. It blew me away the first time I saw it. And I only saw this film maybe 10 years ago for the first time. Again, it wasn't accessible, and you hear a lot of things about it in movie books, and you mark it on your list of things to see. And yes, it's crazy. And I'm still trying to understand why. I mean, I can understand why this film was rejected by any number of studios when the scripts first went out and when the book was published, but it's such an opportunity. The viewpoint we have now is if you get something mind-blowingly different, you want to put it out there. But the studio system in the late 50s and early 60s was so hidebound and conservative, they resisted change at all costs. And therefore, something as controversial as The Manchurian Candidate, where political assassination is portrayed in a film and there are hints of incest between the Raymond Shaw character and his mother, played by Angela Lansbury, who was only a year or two older than him at the time, but makes the world work really well. There was, you know, they had to go with somebody like Frankenheimer, who had a bit of a reputation of doing edgy drama, to do this. And United Artists put up the money, and of course the film was successful. One of the ways that Frankenheimer worked, based on that old TV experience that he had, was to use wide-angle lenses, real locations, and nice depth of focus shots, kind of the same way Orson Welles did in Citizen Kane, but Frankenheimer took it to a new level in some ways. It gives the film a different look than the films contemporary to it. You have a look at another film along similar lines, like Advising Consent, which I mentioned in a previous podcast, filmed in a totally different and slightly more traditional way. But Frankenheimer just did things that hadn't been done before with the film. There were some point of view shots, which are quite telling as well. And the second one of the flashback, the nightmare brainwashing shots, it is quite violent. I mean, the chair gets thrown back, there's blood splattered against the wall or something like that you hadn't seen in film before. Now, there are a few firsts in this film as well. It was the first movie to really take on the McCarthy era in any meaningful way. The father, the stepfather of the Raymond Shaw character, Johnny Island, played by James Gregory, is very much a McCarthy character. He tells how many communists are in the State Department and the numbers always change. He rants and raves in front of the media. He's a buffoon, but a dangerous buffoon. He's a politician version of Glenn Beck in a way. The other first in there, which coming from a background of exploitation films I like, is the fact that Sinatra and Henry Silver have one of the first real full-on karate fights in Hollywood movies. The scene where he spots the guy he met in Korea as Raymond Shaw's butler and immediately attacks him instinctively. It's quite a savage fight. The only thing I can compare it to in the early 60s is that fight between Robert Shaw and Sean Connery in From Rush With Love, that kind of brutal, close-in, restricted space, nasty fighting of experienced fighters, and it kind of works at that level. Sinatra actually broke a little finger on his right hand doing that scene by hitting a table slightly wrong, and the breakaway part of the table was slightly over to one side, and his little finger was never the same again. That works really well, given the fact that, to a certain extent, a lot of the film is a bit talky. The violence comes quite unexpectedly in the context of that part of the film. Yes, there is the violence with the interrogation scenes and the brainwashing scenes. Frankenheimer breaks it up with this very well choreographed, very well done karate scene. I'll talk about the acting a little bit. The acting is universally good. There's not a bad role in it. A lot of the smaller roles were played by actors that Frankenheimer had used in live television in the 50s. James Gregory was one of them. There are a number of other actors in the small roles. Whit Bissell, who a lot of people know from a lot of 1950s horror movies. He'd worked in live television with Frankenheimer as well, and Frankenheimer used these people as kind of a good luck charm. Now, he knew their work. He knew that if he wanted them to improvise, they would improvise brilliantly. He was confident and comfortable in what they could bring to the movie. This is one of Sinatra's best acting roles, undoubtedly. Sinatra, in films like this one and The Man with the Golden Arm in particular, was able to show vulnerability in a way that not too many other major Hollywood stars of his time could. He could show weakness and vulnerability. He never showed giving in to weakness. He was very good at showing doubt and confusion and those sort of things, particularly in this film. It's in the nuances, it's in the small movements of his face and the body language. And Sinatra is a much better actor than he allowed himself to be in a lot of cases, and this is one of the films that really shows that. Then, of course, you've got Lawrence Harvey, fantastic actor. English gave him that slight, being English, it gave him that kind of slight strangeness that the Raymond Shaw character required. He plays basically a prick. Without the brainwashing, Raymond Shaw was pretty much a prick. He was dominated by his mother. He was a character who was confined by his circumstance. And in spite of the fact that he's a bastard and a prick and snobbish and nasty, ultimately, because of that brainwashing, because of that manipulation that we see as the film rolls on, he becomes a sympathetic character. He becomes a character for whom we feel some pity, in that he wasn't allowed to be who he would have been because of numerous circumstances, which, of course, would be spoilers in the film if I told you about them. Janet Leigh has a few good scenes with Sinatra as well. She was a very beautiful woman, but also a good actress and also an intelligent actress. I never saw her play dumb. She was always knowing into films and always confident in her own mind, which wasn't always the case with a lot of other contemporary actors at the time. And then, of course, we've got James Gregory playing the Johnny Island character. Playing weak is something that's not easy for actors to do. Everybody wants to be the hero, and Gregory brings to this character a few moments of vulnerability, which make it one of his better roles as well. And then we come to Angela Lansbury playing the Red Queen in a lot of senses, and you'll understand that if and when you see the film. The incestuous feeling she has for her son, the fact that she's the ultimate manipulator in a lot of ways, which, without giving out spoilers, is the kind of crux of the movie in a lot of ways. A kind of maternal femme fatale in a really weird, twisted and un-noirish kind of way. I'll just play a little bit of her dialogue from the film just to show you what I mean by that. This is towards the end of the film. If you've got any concerns about spoilers, skip about a minute to a minute and 20 seconds ahead, okay?
You are to shoot the presidential nominee through the head. And Johnny will rise gallantly to his feet and lift Ben Arthur's body in his arms, stand in front of the microphones and begin to speak. The speech is short, but it's the most rousing speech I've ever read. It's been worked on here and in Russia on and off for over 8 years. I shall force someone to take the body away from him. Then Johnny will really hit those microphones and those cameras with blood all over him, fighting off anyone who tries to help him, defending America even if it means his own death, rallying a nation of television viewers into hysteria to sweep us up into the White House with powers that will make martial law seem like anarchy. Now, this is very important. I want the nominee to be dead about 2 minutes after he begins his acceptance speech, depending on his reading time under pressure. You are to hit him right at the point that he finishes the phrase, "Nor would I ask of any fellow American, in defense of his freedom, that which I would not gladly give myself, my life before my liberty." Is that absolutely clear?
One of the problems with watching The Manchurian Candidate now, after all these years, is the fact that the plot's been pinched by so many bad TV shows and lesser movies over the years. The brainwashed person who goes and becomes an assassin robot for a foreign power has been done in hundreds of TV shows. So unfortunately, it does seem to have diminished slightly the impact of this film to its detriment. But you can take from that other things as well. I mean, yes, the plot has become a cliche since then. But going back to this as the original and just watching the acting and watching the direction and the camera work and the way that Frankenheimer and his cast tell the story gives a compensating boost to the movie. It is a great film, and it's usually on a lot of people's lists of the top 100 films of all time. The other two films in the Paranoia trilogy, which I'll talk about in a moment, aren't anywhere near that level of popular acclaim, but in themselves are worthy and interesting films. And in just a moment, I'll talk about the second one of those, 7 Days in May.
Why in God's name we elect a man president and try to see how fast we can kill him?
We've been hating the Russians for a quarter of a century. Suddenly we sign a treaty that says in 2 months they're to dismantle their bombs, we're to dismantle ours, and we all ride to a peaceful glory. This country will probably live as if peace were just as big a threat as war.
Damn it, Ray, we could have had our paradise. Yes, by God, we could have had full employment, whopping gross national product, nice cushy feeling that we've got a bomb for every one of theirs. But just as sure as God made the state of Georgia, there'd come one day when they'd have blown us up or we'd have blown them up.
7 Days in May is a 1964 film with a screenplay by Rod Serling, Twilight Zone fame. Stars Burt Lancaster and Kirk Douglas, Frederick March and Ava Gardner. And they'll give you a bit of a plot précis from Wikipedia. So if you hear a page rattle, I've printed off the Wikipedia page. And I'm sorry if you hear some page rattling. Plot centers on the fictitious US President Jordan Lyman, Frederick March. As the story begins, Lyman faces a wave of public dissatisfaction with his decision to sign a treaty with the Soviet Union, an agreement that will supposedly result in both nations simultaneously destroying their nuclear weapons under mutual international inspection. This is extremely unpopular with both the president's opposition and the military, who believe the Soviets cannot be trusted. As the debate over the treaty rages on, an alert and well-positioned Pentagon insider, United States Marine Corporal Colonel Martin Jiggs Casey, Kirk Douglas, becomes aware of a conspiracy among the Joint Chiefs of Staff, led by his own superior officer, the charismatic head of the JCS, Air Force General James Mattoon Scott, Burt Lancaster. As he digs deeper, he uncovers the conspiracy's shocking goal. Scott and his cohorts, Colonel Broderick, Colonel Murdoch, General Hardesty, along with allies in the United States Congress led by Senator Frederick Prentice, influential members of the news media, are plotting to stage a coup d'etat to remove President Lyman and his cabinet 7 days hence. That's pretty much it in a nutshell. Being someone who likes political movies, particularly political movies with a slight science fiction bias, and this one is set a few years in the future from the time it was made, there are things like video phone conferences and things like that which weren't quite technologically available at the time, but incorporated pretty smoothly into the running of the plot. Being a script by Rod Serling, it is very didactic, and there are a number of set speeches there, and there is very much beat them over the head with the moral message kind of things in it. But I think of the three films in the Paranoia trilogy, this is the lesser one, because the plot dynamics in the script kind of restrict Frankenheimer's ability to show rather than tell. The script, I think Serling suffers from the restriction as a scriptwriter that too much of his work is tell rather than show, because he did all the Twilight Zones and things like that, so he was used to that low-budget one-hour or half-hour format television drama, which does mean that this ends up being very much a talky kind of picture rather than an action kind of picture. And there are a couple of set-piece action scenes where a senator who was helping the president investigate the conspiracy, played by Edmund O'Brien, investigates the secret base where James Mattoon Scott is assembling his army teams to take over the media hubs of the nation during the coup d'etat. In general, this is a kind of thought piece. The acting in it is good, and given the fact that it is that kind of didactic, talky thing, there's not too much room for any particular person to shine, but everybody is good and solid and very believable in their roles. Frederick March, who had been in film since Talkies came in, really, he was in the very early Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, is good as the president. I think one of the disconnects that we have in the modern times is seeing a president who's balding and who seems to be in his 60s or 70s. Where, since Reagan, we haven't had a president who was in that kind of age range. And it's been a very long time since Eisenhower, since they had a bald president in the US. So interesting disconnect there for modern viewers. But President Jordan Lyman, and by the way, he is name-checked in The West Wing by the character played by Bradley Whitford, Joshua Lyman. So there's a bit of a name-check on that in The West Wing. He's a good, solid president. He's not brilliant. He's not in any way like Martin Sheen's president in The West Wing, but he's got a few health issues. His blood pressure's too high. He needs a rest. But he seems to be challenged and invigorated by the challenge brought to him by this attempt at a coup d'etat. And it's very hit and miss on whether the coup's going to go through or not. There are a couple of moments where even though they know what's going on, there's still the possibility that it may succeed. And that tension is well played in the dialogue and in the scripting, but it's not really ramped up in the direction. As I said, this is the lesser of the three films for that reason. It's not a bad film in it by any means, but I do think the script lets it down. The script does tend to not necessarily fall back on cliche, but fall back on comfortable ways of conveying the message. And yeah, maybe it was more shocking in 1964 to have the idea of a military general taking over the government of the United States. Ultimately, as we found out with the second Bush administration, it's not really necessary for them to do so if they find the right puppet. Again, it's a movie that's dated. Of the three, it's probably the most dated movie in the fact that we're a lot more worldly now about the manipulations of politics and power and the connections between politics and the media and the military. We've moved into a different era where those things are looked upon very differently than they were at the time. You've got to remember, this is right at the start of the Vietnam War. There wasn't that cynicism about the military that came after Vietnam. There isn't a cynicism about the political process and, of course, about media that there is now. And so I can see that maybe these films were viewed differently than I view them by a 1964 audience. The acting, as I said, is interesting. Frederick March is a good choice for the president, though I think he may have been towards the end of his life and the end of his career at the time, and he doesn't have the dynamism that makes you believe that this guy could run for president and be successful. The other roles, of course, Burt Lancaster always has that kind of brimming energy that he brought to any kind of role there, where even though he's playing essentially a sedentary character, he walks in and out of offices and says things, there is that kind of dynamism about him that makes you believe that at any moment Scott's ready to punch somebody out. Kirk Douglas has a kind of atypical role in his role of Jiggs Casey, the man who discovers the conspiracy and takes it to the president. It's less of an action role for Douglas than he normally has. It's less of a lead role than a secondary role, in a sense. The crises are conscious that Casey has to go through. Yeah, his duty to his superior officer versus his duty to his country, and the uncertainty as to whether there is actually a conspiracy or whether he's just kind of misreading things is something that Douglas does well without doing it brilliantly. But nonetheless, he's good in that. Ava Gardner has a nice smaller role as the former mistress of Scott, who Casey goes to see if he can get more information about the conspiracy, more information about Scott's nature, playing a worldly, intelligent woman who doesn't seem to have any illusions about who she is and what she is and what life has brought her and will bring her in the future. And I kind of like it. I mean, because this was mostly a guy movie, every other character in the movie pretty much is a man, apart from a secretary in the White House. She kind of manages the balance by herself of seeing a different aspect to the roles and the world in Washington, which, while it may seem slightly token, is still a worthwhile thing, and I think it's a nice role for her. The other characters in there, Edmund O'Brien playing a slightly alcoholic senator who decides that he's going to sober up so he can get through this when he's caught by the people at the military base, has some good moments and some good dialogue. He, of all the people, he seems to convey Serling's dialogue more realistically than a lot of the other actors in the film. Well, I don't know whether you agree or not, but I found him the most engaging character in a lot of ways in the film because he was playing it slightly large and not restricting himself. And again, I come back to Serling maybe being too used to television at the time. There wasn't the room for characters to expand and for actors to expand in what they were doing, except at the end where President and Scott meet and the conflict comes to a head. And even then, it does seem slightly muted, but anytime Edmund O'Brien walks onto the scene, I kind of got a lift from his contribution to the film. There are other actors in it. Martin Balsam playing a White House assistant has some good moments in it. Again, James Gregory's in the film as well, playing another military man. And Andrew Duggan, another actor who Frankenheimer worked with in the 50s, is in there playing a friend of Casey's who meets up with the senator as he's investigating the military base and is told that the military base is actually not authorized by the government but is authorized by General Scott himself. It is a kind of talky film, but it is a kind of what-if film as well. It's got that slight science fictional aspect, which even The Manchurian Candidate has. All three of these films have a slight science fictional aspect, a slight what-if to them that makes them slightly unusual for their time. I'll just play another bit of the dialogue from the ultimate confrontation between General James Mattoon Scott and President Jordan Lyman, just to show you what I mean about the dog being good, but being at a level for television rather than a level for cinema.
I could walk out of here tonight and offer myself as candidate for the office of presidency. And by tomorrow morning, I'd be sitting at that desk with precisely the mandate you hold so dear. And what's more, Mr. President, you know it, and I know it, and this country knows it. So don't tell me I'd have seized an office tomorrow without the benefit of support. If you really had the guts to call for a show of hands, you'd be on an airplane right now back to Ohio.
You can ask for and get your show of hands, General. Just wait a year and 9 months for something called election.
A year and 9 months from now, I don't think there'll be an electorate, let alone an election. I think we'll be sitting on our own rubble, a minimum of 100 million dead. And on the gravestone we can carve, they died for Jordan Lyman's concept of peace.
General,
Did it ever occur to you that if you took over this government by force, you wouldn't have to wait a year and 9 months for the funeral? If the Soviet Union saw our government being taken over by a military dictatorship, how long do you suppose it would take them to break the treaty? Possibly even attack us? I think perhaps a question of days, perhaps hours, certainly weeks.
Like all good drama, this one comes not from goodies versus baddies, but from two people who want to protect their country, in this case the president and the general. They both want to protect their country. They've just got incredibly divergent ideas on how exactly to do that. And it's that conflict of ideas rather than conflict of I'm good, you're bad, I'm good kind of duality that makes a good drama. And even though I've got my quibbles about this, it is a good drama. It works as a drama. It was remade a number of years later. I'll just see if I can find out the name of the movie or whether it's got it in what I have here. Yeah, it was remade by HBO in 1994 and renamed The Enemy Within, with Sam Waterston playing the president, Jason Robards as the general, and Forrest Whitaker as the Kirk Douglas role. Followed the plot closely at times, with some changes made for contemporary audiences in the end of the Cold War. However, the ending has changed and some incidents were omitted. I'll have to see if I can track that down just for the sake of watching it. It was nominated for 7 Days in May was nominated for 2 Academy Awards, for Edmund O'Brien for Best Actor in a Supporting Role and for Best Art Direction, Set Decoration, Black and White. At the time, O'Brien won Best Supporting Actor at the Golden Globes that year, while Frederick March, John Frankenheimer and composer Jerry Goldsmith were also nominated. There was a Writers Guild of America Award for Best Written Drama. Rod Serling was nominated for that at the time. So people did consider it to be quality work at the time. So I'm just going to take another break now and I'll talk about the third movie and in some ways the most interesting of the three, 1966 film Seconds.
Oh, the chicken looks delicious.
No, thank you.
Yes, as I was saying, the cost runs in the neighborhood of $30,000. I know this seems rather high, but in addition to the rather extensive cosmetic renovation by way of plastic surgery for you, CPS has to provide a fresh corpse that perfectly matches your physical dimensions and medical specifications.
CPS?
Oh, cadaver procurement section. Look, you sure you don't want this chicken?
Absolutely sure.
Oh, pity. The next step is the carefully planned obliteration of identifiable portions of the cadaver before it is found. Features, dental structure, fingerprints. See, we can't leave anything to chance.
No, I guess not.
Would you mind if...
Please.
Oh, thank you. Now, there is a problem. That the circumstances of your death must be simple. Well, a simple accident, strangely enough, is costly, Mr. Wilson. The trick lies in obliterating just so much and no more, so that an identification still can be made based on, as I say, general dimensions plus a credible sequence of events, witnesses, etc. Well, the whole thing must be very carefully staged. We guarantee a death of this kind. Excuse me. Delicious. They have a wonderful way of baking cheese on it so that it gets very crispy. Now, there are any number of ways you can be found. Excuse me. I mean, your body can be found. The victim of some kind of machinery, an explosion, a hunting misadventure. Oh, but I think these are somewhat too gross for you. I had thought perhaps a hotel room fire. Would you like me to outline the circumstances?
No, thank you.
Oh, good. I was hoping you would agree.
No. I mean, I can't be sure.
Oh, well, of course. Yeah, we can't expect you to decide all at once. Think it over. There's so much else to be done, Mr. Wilson, but if I may say so, the question of death selection may be the most important decision in your life.
Of the three films, Seconds is probably the most horrifying, and that may be partly because I'm pretty much heading towards the age of the protagonist in the film, and I can understand some of his worldview. So I'll just do a bit of a précis on it, of the plot, and start talking about why I like it. Arthur Hamilton, played by John Randolph, is a middle-aged man whose life has lost purpose. He is disengaged from his job as a banker, and the love between him and his wife has dwindled. Through a friend whom he thought was dead years earlier, Hamilton is approached by a secret organisation known simply as The Company, which offers wealthy people a second chance at life. The Company, in the person of Mr. Ruby, played by Jeff Corey, and you heard him in that clip before, interviews Hamilton and resorts to blackmail to convince Hamilton to sign on, foreshadowing the unfortunate consequences of accepting the company's assistance. The Company fakes Hamilton's death for him by means of a phony accident and a corpse disguised as him. Through extensive plastic surgery and psychoanalysis, Hamilton is transformed into Tony Wilson, played by Rock Hudson. As Wilson, he has a new home, a new identity, new friends, and a devoted manservant. The details of his new existence suggest that there was once a real Tony Wilson, but what became of him is a mystery. Okay, I won't go any further than that because there's a couple of really punchy bits towards the end of the film which I don't want to particularly spoil. First off, it kind of goes to the heart of kind of mid-20th century identity of males in Western society. People were told what they should believe, people were told what they should aspire to, how they should have their lives. You know, get a good job, get a wife, get a family, move out into the suburbs, consume, go to church, you know, vote, acquire wealth, raise children, and live your life in certain restrictive terms. And what the tragedy of this film, and in some ways it has been said that the film is kind of a remake of Faust, and I talked about Faust in a previous podcast where I talked about three movies about Faust, but this is definitely a fourth one. But only to a certain extent. The idea of the devil being a corporation is quite appealing, but I think the parallel can only be taken so far. The film's more about that alienation that people felt during those times. And that recent film of DiCaprio's, I forget what it's called, hits a lot of the same notes as the first part of Seconds, where the character played by John Randolph commutes on the train wearing his pork pie hat, reads the newspaper. He's a kind of like faceless part of a mass and only becomes an individual really after he goes through the transformative process that the company literally blackmails him into accepting. He ultimately comes to a certain knowledge about himself, and unfortunately that knowledge comes too late to assist him in improving his life. The knowledge, of course, being that he should be making his own decisions about his life, not based on what he's told by other people, but based on what he feels and believes and knows to be right. The transformation process, I mean, it's a bit simplistic in a sense. Plastic surgery isn't going to make a 55-year-old guy look like Rock Hudson as a younger man. I mean, if they were going to remake it, of course, there'd be nanotechnology involved and renovating telomeres at the end of our DNA molecules. Allowing that one conceit that plastic surgery and exercise and psychoanalysis can turn you into a younger person, the film follows through on its premise very well. This was a big change of role for Rock Hudson. He was used to doing the fluffy, him and Doris Day, lightly flirty sex comedy kind of gigs, and he was looking for a change in his life. And this role's perfect for it, a man pretending to be something he's not, which of course has its parallels in Rock Hudson's own life. He was quite challenged by the role and at times was uncertain. There's a scene where there's a cocktail party at his home as a character of Tony Wilson, where Rock Hudson didn't know how to play the role, so Frankenheimer said, "Well, just get drunk." So basically for the 3 days it took to film that, Rock Hudson was genuinely drunk and was able to play the role by going to the ultimate method process of knocking back a number of drinks. Now, the beach house that the Tony Wilson character has is actually Frankenheimer's own home at the time. Of course, Frankenheimer was so familiar with the filming, a lot of tracking shots through his own house was something that would have been quite easy to do in that sense. We should really talk about the cinematography as well. The title sequence by Saul Bass showing fisheye lens on a close-up on a person's face, which is quite disturbing in its own, really sets this film off to be unsettling. And the almost documentary scenes with the John Randolph version of the character Arthur Hamilton / Tony Wilson do kind of unsettle in a weird way. There's a lot of point of view shots and a lot of fisheye lens kind of things, which aren't used frivolously. They're used to a purpose, and they do carry along the film. And then suddenly he's in the corporate world of the company, which has undertones of menace that are incredibly well portrayed by Frankenheimer and by his actors. The interesting thing is that three of the main actors in this film, John Randolph, Jeff Corey, and Will Gear, who plays an old folksy kind of guy that Wilson meets at the company, were all blacklisted during the McCarthy era, during the anti-communist witch hunts. So, in fact, it was John Randolph's first film role since he was black banned. And so him being a kind of distraught and alienated character was something that, as an actor, he had real-life experience to draw on. People's careers were truncated and cut in half by that. Jeff Corey as well, he went through the same thing, as indeed did Will Gear, who himself had the added complication of being a homosexual. And so that, plus these political beliefs, led to him being black-banned almost until the mid-60s. So like for a 10-15-year period, these people's careers were incredibly truncated. Jeff Corey went into teaching acting and became a very famous acting teacher during that time in order to make a living. The film is, it kind of crosses several genres. I mean, there's the drama aspect of alienated middle 20th century middle-aged man and how he tries to escape from the self-imposed prison of life as he was living it. There's the horror aspect of the true nature of the company as it becomes slowly and increasingly apparent. And there's a science fiction aspect of the rejuvenation of the character. Now, the cinematography was done by James Wong Howe, who was probably the best black and white cinematographer operating at the time. He did a lot of handheld camera work, which added to the sense of realism in a number of scenes. There were some shots where it seemed that the Rock Hudson character and also John Randolph in one sense were being pushed around on a trolley with the camera fixed behind them to give that sense of the camera looking over their shoulder. So very creepy camera work in a lot of ways, but it was always to a strong purpose. There was always a definite reason for these things to occur and for things to be filmed in the way they were. There's a party celebrating Bacchus where there's wine, you know, crushing the grapes, and people strip off and jump into the wine vat to crush grapes and things like that. And in the extended version of the film, there is a bit of nudity, which is always appreciated. The film is a genuine cautionary tale. It's one of those ones saying, live your life on your own terms. Be who you really should be. Be who you know yourself to be, rather than letting everybody else tell you what you should be and who you should be. Ultimately, that film becomes a tragedy in the sense that the character finds out too late how he should be living his life. And for that reason, as I get into my middle years, or in the second half of my life, I find that to be more poignant and more interesting than I did maybe when I saw it as a young person. Was profoundly shocked by the climaxes of the film. There are actually two emotional climaxes to the film. The first, when he discovers what his new life is, and the second, when he revisits the company. So I won't talk too much more about Seconds. It is a genuinely disturbing film, and it's a film which links science fiction back into the zeitgeist of the times, the man in the grey flannel suit stereotype of, you know, the kind of madmen, to use a more modern way of looking at it, stereotype of middle century corporate America. somebody ultimately is going to remake the film. I don't have any doubts about that. I don't think they'll do it as well. And I don't think it's necessary that they do so. But I think the message of the film is one that does bear repeating in a time when people are feeling more and more like their options aren't as large as they were, and that they're not living the life they should be living. So that's about it for seconds. I'm just going to play some more music for you, and I'll wind up this longer than usual podcast.
Domani, forget domani. Let's live for now and then. Who needs domani? The moonlight, let's share the moonlight. Perhaps together we will never be again. Oh, che luna, oh, che mare. With such a moon and such a sea, and you with me. I get so dizzy when you're standing near. It's not the music that you hear. My heart is beating like the jungle drums. Let's take the minutes as they speed away, and hope it's true what the people say. When you're in love, domani never comes. Let's forget about domani. Let's forget about domani. Let's forget about domani. For domani never comes. Let's forget about tomorrow. Let's forget about tomorrow. Let's forget about tomorrow. For tomorrow never comes. Domani, forget domani. With such a moon and such a sea, and you with me. Let's take them minutes as they speed away, and hope it's true what the people say. When you're in love, the money never comes. So let's forget about domani. Let's forget about domani. Let's forget about domani. For domani.
That was Catinho Ranieri with Forget the Money from the film The Yellow Rolls-Royce, sticking to the theme of Italian movie music, or pseudo-Italian movie music of the 1960s that I had in this podcast. That's about it. I'm going to let Sal do the contact details now at the end of the podcast. I'll be back in 3 weeks' time doing something else entirely. Not at all sure what it will be. I'm going to try to kind of balance up serious stuff with light stuff a little bit in the future. So I may look at some more exploitation films that cross my screen in the next 3 weeks. So thank you very much for your attention, and I hope your movie viewing is going well. I hope that everybody's well and fit and happy, got through Halloween okay, and heading towards the ho-ho-ho season. Bye for now, and enjoy your movies.
Paleo Cinema is a 3-weekly podcast that looks at film noir, horror, cult movies, classic films, science fiction, and other genre works from 1895 to 1980. The email address is cultguru@gmail.com, cultguru@gmail.com. So please send comments, feedback, and MP3 voicemails to that address. The blog for the podcast, which has lots of extra content relating to each episode and a chat window where you can interact with other listeners, is paleo-cinema.blogspot.com. This podcast contains adult content and occasional swearing, so don't lend your MP3 player to children.